The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. My dear listeners, today we learn the depths of true friendship, from backing up pretty tall tales to ensuring no rib is left behind. First up, Bill and Skeeter are at it again, from the book Inept, Impaired, Overwhelmed, Tall Tales from West Virginia and Beyond, written by Bill Lepp and published in 2012, the namesake chapter, Impaired, Inept, Overwhelmed. Rock climbing is a sport involving much skill and technique. Therefore, it is clearly not a sport Skeeter and I were in any way prepared to undertake. It also involves a lot of gear, like rope, harnesses, carabiners, D-rings, and special shoes. And thus, it involves a lot of money. Skeeter and I, being sophomores in high school, had little money. With no skill and no money, we were utterly unqualified to be rock climbers. All we had were our amazing powers of reason and our motto, which we had borrowed from the Marine Corps, improvise, adapt, overcome. My father, always willing to encourage our endeavors, suggested the motto might better define Skeeter and me if it was impaired, inept, overwhelmed. But we wanted to be rock climbers, and so we put our amazing powers of reason to work. First of all, we reasoned, everyone has rope. Why buy expensive climbing rope when there were miles of rope in Dad's shed just waiting to be used? We figured we could make a harness out of just about anything. As far as special shoes, we reckoned that if the 82nd Airborne could win World War II in parachute boots, then we could rock climb in parachute boots. As for carabiners and D-rings, well, we had enough money to buy a few of those, provided they were absolutely necessary. So there we were, standing under the New River Gorge Bridge, its massive primer red arch spanning the canyon above our heads, the pounding flow of the rapids in our ears, and the dry rock of a cliff beckoning us. We had looked at a map of the canyon's best climbs and had chosen an area called Where Real Men Dare, for obvious macho reasons. This was a climb that was supposedly for beginners. In retrospect, I think the idea was that it was a climb for beginners who were properly versed and outfitted in rock climbing. No one bothered to tell Skeeter and I that bit of information, not that it would have made any impression. Furthermore, we decided on Where Real Men Dare because our other choices had included climbs called Beginners Only and Monkey See, Monkey Do. We were too proud to do Beginners Only, and Monkey See, Monkey Do hit a little too close to home. We had also avoided the more advanced climbs, including Leave It to Jesus. We skipped that one because, as sophomores in high school, we were certain that Jesus was sufficiently unimpressed with our behavior and would likely not come to our aid. The main reason we decided to start on a beginner's level climb wasn't because we couldn't handle a more advanced climb, but because we were testing experimental equipment and thought it might be better to start slow. Skeet, I said, staring up the rock face, if the rope is supposed to keep us from falling off the cliff, shouldn't it be tied to something above our heads? He pondered that and said, well, that does seem prudent, but how do we get it up there? I've told you 1,000 times, I said accusingly, that you should have bought that grappling hook at Sullivan's Flea Market. And I've told you 1,000 times that it's not a grappling hook, it's an anchor. Just then, someone above us yelled, rope! A coil of brightly colored climbing rope arced above our heads, and the loose end fell to the ground nearby. I bet, I said, that they tied the other end of that rope to a tree or something up there, and that now they are going to rappel down and then climb back up. You, Skeeter mocked, are a genius. A silhouetted figure appeared on the cliff above our heads. She was clad in a helmet, a t-shirt, and stretchy pants. She looked down and said, "Hi." We waved. She was fastening a rope to a ring tied to her harness. She stepped to the very edge of the cliff and pulled the rope taut. She said to someone we couldn't see, "Rappelling! Rappel on!" a voice replied. As if she were sitting down in space, she leaned out over the edge of the cliff until her legs were perpendicular to the face of the rock, and only the rope supported her weight. She bent her knees and then pushed herself off the cliff. Her body arced out from the rock, and she zipped down the rope. As she swung back toward the cliff, she bent her knees, hit the rock gracefully, bounced, and landed softly beside us. She set about unfastening the rope. She was about 20 years old and fantastically beautiful. "Wow, you're pretty good at that," I said. "So now that person up there is going to come down?" She nodded. "And then you'll climb back up?" Skeeter asked. She nodded. She tilted her head and examined our gear and us. Her eyes narrowed in wonder, or maybe awe, or maybe plain old confusion. She looked at us the same way my mother had looked at us, just before querying, "Now tell me again why you put the cat in the dishwasher?" And then our newly descended acquaintance asked, "Have you guys ever climbed before?" We nodded our heads emphatically. "Oh, yes, sure, lots of times, all over this canyon, up and down." She raised her eyebrows. "You've climbed down?" I looked at Skeet. He shrugged. I said, as confidently as I could, trying to sound aloof, "How else do you get down?" "Usually," she said, "you rappel." "Sure," Skeet rejoined. "I mean, that's the easy way." "Tell me," she asked, "why do the two of you have knapsacks on your rear ends?" Skeeter and I both glanced self-consciously at our posteriors. In our efforts to improvise and adapt, we had invented our own harnesses. All the harnesses we had seen in the climbing store were made of heavy webbing. The harnesses wrapped around the waist and inner thighs, much like a diaper. They were also expensive. The knapsacks that we had carried our lunches in, however, were not expensive, and the shoulder straps were made of the same heavy webbing as the harnesses. Both packs had waist straps as well. I pointed out to Skeeter that we could simply step through the shoulder straps, pull them up like pants, cinch them tight, put the waist straps through our belt loops, and viola, a harness. As an added benefit, the pouches of the packs were just at our hind ends, so we stuck pillows in them to act as seats, or serve as cushions should we fall. Whoever she was, our new friend was doubled over, pointing and laughing. She finally managed to cough out, "Karen, come down quick! You gotta see this!" Karen, who was still at the top of the cliff, finished rigging the rope, leaned over the cliff, gave the commands, and slid gently down to us. Karen took one look at our harnesses and started laughing with her friend. Even the cleverest ideas of a sophomore boy seem stupid and awkward when said boy is suddenly being laughed at by beautiful young women. Skeeter and I stood stock still. With luck, I was thinking, we could come up with a good story to cover our appearances and still get a date with these girls. "We're testing this equipment for the Army. We're Special Forces," Skeeter said. I grimaced. So much for a date. While Skeeter was busy letting the women in on our top-secret mission for the Pentagon, I was doing what I could to nonchalantly cover our coil of rope before it too was spied. Having seen the compact, brightly colored, sleek climbing rope the women had used, I had come to the conclusion that our rope was not, in any way, proper climbing gear. It was, instead, 80 feet and about 200 pounds of the 3-inch diameter brown rope used for mooring naval cruisers to giant cleats in deep sea ports. It was identical to the rope we had to climb in gym class, and since our teacher always referred to that rope as the climbing rope, we naturally assumed that 3-inch naval line was what we needed in the New River Gorge. It had taken both of us to lug the rope to the base of the cliff, and now I was trying to push it behind a rock without being noticed. "Is that your climbing rope?" Karen asked. "This? No," I stammered. I was loath to follow Skeeter's special forces lie, but I couldn't come up with anything else. "This is the rope to the helicopter used to lower our jeep into the canyon. We were practicing early afternoon heli drops into hostile landing zones. Part of our training involved getting out of the gorge by climbing." "So where's the jeep?" Karen's friend asked. "It fell in the river. An experienced pilot," Skeet said. "So?" Karen asked, obviously humoring us. "Then where's your climbing rope?" "In the jeep," I said. "So your orders," Karen's friend asked, "were to be lowered into the gorge with a jeep and then climb out?"
"Yes."
"So how were you going to get the jeep out?"
"I shouldn't be sharing this information with you," Skeet said, lowering his voice and looking around.
He paused, beckoned the women closer, and whispered,
"The jeep was just a decoy. I'm afraid that's all I can say on the matter."
He grabbed the shoulder straps of the knapsack he was wearing upside down around his legs and hiked it up, as though it were a gun belt with a 6-shooter slung low. They smiled kindly.
"Look," Karen said, "it's obvious that you guys are experienced climbers, trained the army way."
We nodded.
"But," she continued, "well, my friend and I are instructors here at the New River Gorge. We were just about to start a class. We are meeting right here in about 20 minutes. I bet you two could make it back up to town, sign up for the class, and still be back here in time to sit in. The proper gear, including helmets and harnesses, are provided. That is, if you would like to learn the civilian method of climbing, and if it wouldn't interfere with your mission."
We smiled, slipped out of our knapsacks, and jogged to the car. For once in our lives, we sat still in class and actually excelled.
And now, my dear listeners, gather round and hear about the infamous, sort of, rib. From Lori Nataro's book, Enter Pirates, Vintage Legends, 1991 through 1999, published in 2016, the chapter, Enter Pirates. It was only a rib. Jim had already taken advantage of 7 of them with the all-you-can-eat platter, and the 8th one simply wasn't going down. It rested alone on the dish, the lone survivor of a mad eating rampage, the results of which sat on an opposing plate, white, shiny, and gnawed. The last rib bothered Jim. He looked at it. He touched it a little, toyed with the idea of perhaps taking just one bite so that leaving it on the plate untouched wouldn't seem so wasteful. He looked at me. "Should I eat it?" he questioned. I shrugged. "I really can't. I mean, really, I can't." I nodded. "I can't just leave it here. It's a perfectly good rib." "I know," I agreed. "But what are you going to do with one rib? Nobody ever ate just one rib. It's only one rib. That's why they have it listed in plural on the menu. Ribs." "It would make a good weapon," he said, thinking. "Or I could dig holes with it." "Why just take that one, then?" I responded. "Let's bag all of the bones, pick up some cinder blocks and a couple of milk crates on the way home, and you can build yourself a mortal remains entertainment center with them." He ignored me. "I have a feeling about this rib," he said.
This rib is special. Don't ask me to explain it. I can't. It's just a feeling.
My God, Jim, it's a rib, I argued. Don't tell me you see the image of a savior in it.
He looked at the rib closely, rather studied it, and then looked at me.
No, it's not Jesus, he whispered, but this rib is holy. I'm telling you, it has a purpose.
All right, Jim, if you say so, I gave in. When the waiter comes back around, ask him if he can wrap it up in the shroud of Turin instead of a sheet of tin foil. After we had the rib, as it became known, wrapped, blessed, and anointed, we headed towards our friend Dave's house to see if his girlfriend would let him out of the house for the night. We had one problem, though. Dave's girlfriend hated us. She hated us a lot. More than that. In fact, I think it would be a fair statement to say that Dave's girlfriend super hated us, maybe even to the point of loathing. Apparently, she hated Jim and me for a variety of reasons, which included, but were not limited to, the fact that Dave liked us, the fact that Dave had fun with us, the fact that we had senses of humor and that she had never gotten around to purchasing one. She hated us because she thought that we made Dave drunk, although it is a well-known fact that he never needed any general prodding in that area. It was only a rib. Jim had already taken advantage of 7 of them with the all-you-can-eat platter, and the 8th one simply wasn't going down. It rested alone on the dish, the lone survivor of a mad eating rampage, the results of which sat on an opposing plate, white, shiny, and gnawed. The last rib bothered Jim. He looked at it. He touched it a little, toyed with the idea of perhaps taking just one bite so that leaving it on the plate untouched wouldn't seem so wasteful. He looked at me. Should I eat it? He questioned. I shrugged. I really can't. In any case, she hated us. But she hated me more than Jim because, well, I'm a chick and she's a chick, and chicks hate other chicks just because they're chicks, I guess. She actually hated me more than a regular chick because I was a single chick. Dave's girlfriend didn't take too kindly to the fact that the three of us were spending time together, and Jim and I felt bad about this because we both liked her. She made great dips and always served an unrivaled fruit platter when she and Dave had parties. We tried to be nice to her, but she would still have no part of us, not even when I told her that she looked thin. Then, one night, Jim and I won a pink Playboy bunny sticker in a gumball machine and figured that Dave's mailbox was as good of a place as any to put it on, and also kinda because we thought it might piss his girlfriend off a little. However, the next day, Dave told us that his girlfriend thought it was funny and actually chuckled at it. Naturally, Jim and I thought we were accomplishing great strides in the effort to make her like us, and that she might give Dave permission to spend more time than just one night a week with us. This was a good thing, since our duties as Dave's bad influences not only required dragging him through the seedy underbelly of alcoholism, but we also had plans to hold him down and make him smoke crack until he was an addict, and then we were going to pimp him out so we could, in turn, buy more drugs. You see, we needed to influence Dave at least twice a week. So, to us, it seemed like the right thing to do that night after we had eaten dinner, to bring his girlfriend an offering. Jim and I dug through the trash in the car, only to come up with 217 cigarette butts from the ashtray and 3 decomposing meatballs from underneath the passenger seat that my Nana had given me 2 weeks before, but that I forgot about. Neither of them felt very friendly, and we were stumped until we spied the hallowed remnant of Jim's all-you-can-eat special, the rib. It was perfect. Oh, my God, I said to Jim excitedly. Enter pirates! He looked at me and didn't say anything. Enter pirates! I said again, almost shouting. I had a Shakespeare class the year before, and we read Pericles, which is a play about a very happy king and his queen, a shipwreck, and the play is going along very nicely, and then the stage directions say, Enter pirates. Just like that. No warning, no foreshadowing, all of a sudden, pirates. And life is like that, I explained to Jim as we drove over to Dave's house. Enter pirates. One minute, your life is plodding along on its path, and then the next thing you know, there is a tickly beard in your ear and a sword at your throat. Or a rib in your mailbox. We knew it was perfect, as we quietly slipped it into the mailbox, and we were so happy with ourselves that we couldn't help but giggle a little when we knocked on the door and Dave answered it. Dave, on the other hand, didn't look so happy. His face was all red, his shirt was half untucked, and he had little beads of sweat on his forehead and above his upper lip. Dave looked like he was drunk. Dave looked like hell. Dave was in trouble. She's not going to work tonight, he told us. She wants to stay home and fight. I think I'm grounded. What are you fighting about? We asked. He laughed. Well, it was all about what an a-hole I was before, he said. But I'm sure when I go back in the ring, it will now be about you guys. The following day, neither of us heard from Dave, and far be it from me and Jim to stir up the hornet's nest, so we decided to lay low until Dave made contact with us. We knew he was so far in the doghouse that she had probably nailed the bathroom door shut and was making him crap in the grass. Finally, several days later, Dave was able to spring himself from the house unnoticed long enough to make contact with us via a payphone. That was a good sign, since we had expected that Dave would only be able to communicate through messenger birds, using leaves for paper and his blood for ink. We made arrangements to meet for drinks later that night and talk about what happened with the ball and chain. But when I saw him sitting at the bar, I didn't expect him to be in the shape he was in. There he was, a shot of whiskey in one hand and a lit Marlboro in the other, his face robust and rich, his eyes alive. He was smiling. He was giddy. I had never seen him so happy. I seriously doubt that I'll ever see him that happy again until the day he gets off parole and he gets his civil rights reinstated. Dave, you look like a new man, Jim and I agreed. Are you kidding? Klaus von Bülow never felt this happy, Dave smiled. Can you tell us what happened? We asked. Well, after you left, we actually worked a lot of things out, he said. She decided that I needed to be more attentive and to recognize her feelings, and I decided I was going to start lacing her food with Prozac. So everything was going along fine. She even stopped talking long enough at one point that I caught a 15-minute nap. And then she found the rib. My stomach and lower intestines felt like I had been eating Pop Rocks and drinking Pepsi, which is what I believe really killed River Phoenix. Dave relayed the sequence of events this way. Apparently, Dave's neighbor across the street was quite fond of beating the hell out of his wife, and several nights before, one of the other neighbors called the police. As the wife-beating neighbor was being arrested and shoved in the back seat of the patrol car, he spotted Dave's girlfriend, who was watching the commotion and being nosy, and screamed to her that he was going to get her for calling the cops on him. So when she went to the mailbox that fateful morning and found the rib, she somehow equated this to the threat and became convinced that the rib had become a symbol of her death at the hands of the wife-beating neighbor. She became very excited and adamant about calling the police because the neighbor had left a body part in her mailbox, just like the mafia does, and that the rib needed to be dusted for fingerprints as proof. Dave looked at the rib and knew immediately that it was the work of myself and Jim, and in a feeble attempt to calm her down, he told her this. In a boomerang turn of events, Dave's girlfriend became even more agitated and began screaming louder that he needed to make friends with a better class of people, that it's time that girl realized she's almost 30, and I bet they were drunk or spaced out on drugs when they did it. Or, in other words, enter pirates. I am not almost 30, I said through clenched teeth when Dave was finished.
And what did you say, Dave? Jim ventured.
I said, I'm moving out, and then I called U-Haul, Dave answered.
I have a year and a half before I'm 30, I protested.
God, Dave, I'm sorry, Jim said, shaking his head.
Nah, it's okay. I should have just told her that the rib is an old family tradition. You see, you put a dime in the mailbox every day for a month, and on the last day, the rib fairy brings you a rib. And now, because she's not a family member, and she touched the rib, it's all ruined, and that I've got to start my cycle all over again.
I'm sorry, Dave, I said. We never wanted you guys to split up.
No, we never wanted you guys to break up, Jim agreed.
Actually, we did, I confessed.
Yeah, we did, Jim nodded.
Her dips weren't that good, I mentioned.
Well, I did like the caramel fondue stuff she made for those apples, Jim threw in. It was so creamy.
She bought it pre-made at the store, Dave offered. It's in the produce section.
Jim gasped.
This whole time, if I just could have known that all it was going to take was a rib, I would have sent you guys to Sizzler long ago, Dave reflected. I might have even paid for the dinner.
I don't know, I agreed. It was only a rib.
Who knew?
I knew, Jim noted. I told you that rib was holy.
So whatever happened to the rib? I asked. Did you eat it?
No, she threw it away when she realized she didn't need it for evidence, Dave answered. It was only one rib. Nobody eats just one rib.
True, we agreed. Sometimes, though, one rib is more than enough.
We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Are you enjoying the show? Do you have any humorous quotes or authors you'd like to share? We'd love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number, one more time, is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.